right. Well, Erin, do you think we should get going since we have some guest speakers that are going to be talking today?
I think so. Maybe we should just go through the full sheet and see if anyone else joined, and then go ahead and get started with the guest presenters. Sure. All right. So this is Erin in Juneau, and I'm sitting next to Cindy Phillips and Norm Wooten from AASB, and Courtney, a fellow colleague here at the department. I want to see, is board member Kenny Gallivorn on the line with us this morning? Okay, and I know John Harmon wasn't able to join. What about Lieutenant Colonel Toole? Okay, I heard Kathy Comack. Geraldine Kelly, are you on the line? Okay, I know we've got Rachel Roy with us. What about Janet Beifelt, are you on the line? Okay. Senator Begich, are you on the line this morning? Okay. I heard Representative Fansler. What about Representative Kopp? Are you on the line this morning?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. I heard Tiffany Jackson. What about Carrie Boyd? Are you with us this morning? Okay. Tim Parker, are you with us this morning? All right. I know Steve said he wasn't able to join. I heard Hattie's on the line for Melanie. Commissioner Hoddick, are you on the line? Okay. I know Valerie Davison will be joining us closer to 10 o'clock. Kathy Wasserman, are you on the line? Okay. What about Dina Mitchell? Liz Medicine Crow?
Good morning.
Good morning. And Hunter Carter. Okay. So, and with that, I will turn it over to Timmy.
Well, good morning, everyone. We're thrilled to have those of you that are here on the phone. We've got some really important work to do, and we need to really start wrapping our head around where we're headed. I hope that those of you that weren't here last time have had a chance to look at our minutes and go through everything that was talked about during that meeting. It was a really productive meeting, and I felt good about the outcomes. But we have three big chunks that we're going to be talking about this morning. We have some guest speakers that will be presenting to the group, and then we have two pockets of those. We have the folks from ICC who are going to be sharing out what's worked really well for them and their according to their plan, and maybe some hurdles they've run into, and we can have time for questions and answers with them. And then we have folks from First Alaskans and AASB who are going to be presenting out to us a little bit about our community conversations that have been happening around, and some school safety and school climate topics that have been happening around the state. And then last but not least, when Commissioner Davidson arrives online, she's going to be speaking to us a little bit and sharing with us a little bit more, just some explanation around compacting and what that might look like. And so, can I just see, are our guest speakers on the phone?
Yes, Pauline Harvey with ICC Alaska is here.
Oh, great.
And Timmy, Lori Graskin's here, and Andrea said she was going to join at 9:30.
Perfect. Well, that's perfect because Pauline is our first guest speaker. And Pauline, I'm thrilled you're online, and I know that you and Jerry Covey are both up in the Kotzebue area right now, and so I really, really appreciate you accepting our offer to come and speak to us. And so with no further ado, and Pauline, please spend a little more time introducing yourself to the group, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, okay?
Wonderful. Thank you. My name is Pauline Harvey, and I'm actually from the village of Norvik, which is up in the Northwest Alaska region. I currently have been here in Anchorage for the last 2 years and working on the third year shortly of this ANEP grant, which is the Alaska Native Education Program, Department of Education grant that I have been sitting at the helm of for the last 2 years. My history is that I spent 30 plus years as an elementary school teacher, K-12 principal up in my region, as well as teaching elementary school here in Anchorage for the last, for 14 years before I went back home to work as a principal in Nordic and Catalina. And then I also ran the UA Chukchi campus in Kotzebue for about 5 years. So I spent nearly 10 years back home after I had spent some time teaching as well. So that's my history as far as my work with K-12 education and higher education. And so for the last two years now, I've been, again, at the helm of this grant. It's titled From Decolonization to Conscientization, which is implementing the Alaskan Inuit Education Improvement Strategy, which is, of course, funded by the DOE ANUP grant. ICC Alaska, of course, you are well aware, is a nonprofit organization to be the unified voice of Alaskan Inuit and to promote, protect, and advance Inuit culture and society. Our membership includes the Inupiaq of the North Slope, Northwest, and Bering Straits, the St. Lawrence Islands, Yupik, Central Yupik, and Chupik of the Yukon-Kuskokwim region. The member organizations include North Slope Borough, Inupiaq Community of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Northwest Arctic Borough, Manulak Association, Nana Regional Corporation, Kuwerik, Bering Straits Native Corporation, and the Association of Village Council Presidents. We are a member, national member of ICC International, which is an international indigenous non-governmental organization and NGO. So the background and the history of our education project, which we basically call the Alaskan Inuit Education Improvement Strategy. The background is that in September of 2013, ICC Alaska initiated the development of the education strategy, which was identified as a priority set by the Board of Directors for the 2010-2014 term. This was in response to our new declaration, 2010-2014, and renewed in the Kitikmeot Declaration 2014 to 2018, which calls on ICC to share best practices across the circumpolar Arctic, development and improvement of culturally appropriate curriculum, and in the inclusion of our Inuit languages as a critical component of education. And so that's the background of how this project was developed. And since then, the grant started. I basically, in the last 2 years, I have traveled all the way from Barrow to Bethel, Kotzebue, and Nome regions, visiting basically every school district and superintendent and boards, and presenting the Alaskan Education Improvement Strategy to them, as well as getting an idea of where our languages are and what types of Inuit values and cultural curriculum are being used in the schools. And then after I did the initial visit, then I proceeded to have within each of the four regions, which is the North Slope region, Northwest Arctic region, the Bering Straits region, and the Southwest region, what we called our decolonization think tanks. And that occurred also within these last 2 years, actually within the last probably year and a half. And I pulled together, we pulled together the people that work on the ground that are teaching the languages, that are teaching the values in the schools, basically the ones that are doing the Inuit work in the schools. I have on my, I'm basically led by our steering committee, which is a membership of five, one from each region, including a youth representative. And these people are Jana Harturek out of North Slope. We have Terry Walker out of the Northwest Arctic region, and we have the IUC, which is Bernadette Alabama Simple out of the Bering Straits region, and then Janet Johnson represents the Southwest region. We also have Madeline Alabama Simple, who's our youth representative on the steering committee. And so we've also included, we've had steering committee meetings basically every, at least for each one of the regions, we've had a steering committee meeting in each one of the regions. If you have an opportunity to take a look at our, at the document I sent you, that is more of a longer version of the new pamphlet that we've put out, which is, of course, our Alaskan Inuit Education Improvement Strategy, which is based on the need that ICC Alaska as well as ICC International saw for an opportunity to improve education for our Alaskan and our international Inuit students who are not doing very well in the current educational system. The scores show that they're not up to par with a lot of the other, for example, the urban regions in their testing. And so we put together a meeting in 2014, which we held in Nome. That was the initial meeting. And at that time, currently, I was sitting on the steering committee, working out of Kotzebue, directing the Kutchie campus. And then I decided to move to town. My daughter started nursing school. And, well, she just basically graduated now 2 weeks ago. And so she's starting the UAA nursing project. She's getting ready to take her NCLEX and will be looking at ANMC as a RN. Anyway, I came back to town and I was asked, basically I was hired to go ahead and monitor and be at the helm of this grant. So if you had a chance to look at the document, we have in the document six strategies facilitated, of course, by us, initiated by the ICC Alaska Education Workshop that started in 2014, initial meeting in Nome. If you had a chance to look through the strategies, you know, the first strategy is to promote the indigenization of education frameworks to more clearly align with Inuit ideologies. We have in Barrow, for example, in Northwest North Slope, Alaska, we have the EFAP learning framework, which is basically this idea that you will use knowledge of our elders and the regional knowledge to promote a strong sense of Inuit identity. And so students in the North Slope region, for example, have the best learning framework, and they learn about their own ways. You know, they learn about the Whalings, they learn values, they learn language, and it's led by the district board mandated the curriculum. And so they're when you walk into the schools, you can see that the texts are based on their own lifestyle, their own languages, you know, their value system based on the Whaling community there. Strategy two is to suggest, advocate for, and influence policies related to Inuit education. And our role has been basically to step up and promote policies that are related to Inuit education. For example, you know, we've been very involved with the Alaska, with the language project out of Juneau. Strategy three is to research, advocate for, and promote the development, implementation, and sharing of culture-based curriculum that focuses on students' Inuit identity, and basically to engage in teaching others on culture-based curriculum resources and to disseminate this information, et cetera. Again, this ties in very nicely with the Inuit Path Learning Framework of North Slope. then strategy four is to promote the English language education. And of course, I've been very involved with the Alaska Native Language Preservation and Advisory Council, and we formed an MOU with them to support the work that they're doing. Yayuk Bernadette Alvena Simple System, that's on the Alaska Native Language Preservation Advisory Council, ANOPAC. And so we're working closely, I've worked closely with them for the last 2 years, attending all of their meetings. We have pockets of language nests throughout the state, throughout the Inuit Alaska regions. You know, in Barrow, they have their work that they've done there. Northwest Arctic region, we have a school there that's, you know, based on Inuit Bap language, as well as Bethel region has their school as well, based on their Yupik and St. Lawrence languages, Chupik languages. Bering Straits also has done some work in those areas. The fifth strategy is to foster educational leadership capacity among the Alaskan Inuit, and we're trying to encourage our youth to take up the slack and look for opportunities to become involved in public office or positions on boards as well as in education. And then finally, the last strategy is to revitalize and reclaim traditional Inuit parenting skills. And we realized that one of the things that we've noticed is that there, we have lots of young parents in the rural regions that are not practicing and encouraging their own families and young families to participate in traditional hunting and subsistence activities, for example. One of the things that we've done to promote that is we created a poster with Element Agency that we just sent out to all the regions that encourages, you know, the mentorship that our young parents need. So these are the six strategies that we have created with the Alaska Inuit Education Improvement Strategy. We're also planning, this is now the end of the second year of the grant, and so we're planning on taking a trip in February. My steering committee and myself and a representative from each of the regions to Greenland, to Nuuk, Greenland, in which we will be sharing this project with Greenland, Canada, and Chukotka, who are the other countries that are involved in ICC International. And then we'll be, basically the grant ends at the end of next year. And I'm not certain, I don't believe we will be asking for additional funding to promote the work. What we've basically done in each of the regions is, you know, we've created a document. If you look on ICCAlaska.org, you will see the particular reports that came out of each region, starting with Nome and then Kotzebue and Barrow and then Bethel region, where we met in each one of the hubs to create a plan, you know, to help each region have language to continue the work that we started. And we call these our decolonization think tanks. Those went very well and were very well attended. We also had last year, we had an education alignment summit in November, in which we brought together all the boards, regional boards, superintendents, all the teachers that are working on the ground in the schools on language and values, new values in the schools to Hilton, and we had an education alignment summit. That the report is also on the ICCAlaska.org website. We work closely with Jared Stewart, who is our facilitator for for the decolonization think tanks as well as for the Education Alignment Summit that we held in November of last year. Let's see, the highlights I would say are that, you know, everyone has spent, each one of the four regions has spent, you know, that they promote and that they use, and it seemed like every region really had a sincere desire to promote their languages, to promote their values, and our idea was to give them a kind of a blueprint or a language that they could use, that they created for themselves to use in each of their regions to promote this. The hurdles that I saw was that, you know, was that everybody has a lot of responsibility, and a lot of the teachers, for example, that are teaching on the ground at the schools under the school districts, they really want to have an opportunity to share materials, you know, to create more materials and so forth. And what I discovered was that in each region was that because of the budget cuts, et cetera, there was less, you know, less funding for materials and for history to create more of the curriculum, culture-based curriculum that focuses on students' Inuit identity. And then of course the other hurdle is that this was a very short lived grant, and then of course, like I said, we have 1 year left in the grant, and then the grant ends, and so, you know, that's the nature of grants, is that they do end, and our hope is that the work will continue, because we basically created a, like I said, a skeleton or a framework that each region can use their own, using their own wishes and their own language to continue to promote improvement for our Inuit students, basically focusing on our languages and focusing on our own identities. The fact that, you know, that we're capable of creating success for our Inuit students. I realize that this is not a statewide effort, and it's been focused on our ICC Alaska region, which is, you know, from Kuskokwim to Northwest Arctic to Bering Straits, and then to the Southwest region, which is the Bethel region. That's kind of it in a nutshell. You know, I believe that the work that we started can be used, you know, in each region. But I also think that, you know, that it's also a statewide. It's a statewide desire, you know, to improve education in particular for our Inuit students, the students that are in the rural sites that have had tremendous challenges as far as when I was working as a principal, for example, in Tivolina, I noticed that a lot of the teachers would just come for 1 or 2 years and leave because they couldn't handle being in such a remote place. And I think one of the other things that we looked at quite closely was teacher certification and how we could create more ways to, creative ways to have more of our own Inuit teachers in our schools. And I was working with Commissioner Johnson on taking a look at some of those pieces.
Pauline, thank you so much. I think that the work you've been doing in that region is a good model for this committee to look at, and that's why we have suggested them reading your booklet that encompasses your goals and the work you've been doing. I would like to open it up to the group and see if anybody has any specific questions they'd like to ask Pauline about the work they've been doing.
Hey, Timmy, this is Dina Mitchell. And Pauline, thank you so much. So I'm with Great Alaska Schools. And I'm just curious, the report was, I thought, wonderful and had a lot of really good recommendations, particularly the parent support and community engagement pieces, you know, near and dear to our hearts, aside from the funding issue. But I'm wondering, out of all of the, you've got so much experience in different communities, out of all of the recommendations that the report put out, what do you think the one thing would be that would have the most impact? And I understand that's hard to isolate, but...
I think that looking at the various decolonization think tanks that we attended, I think each one of the four regions all had the same desire, and that was to promote Inuit identity and to encourage our regional educational systems to continue to focus on strengthening Inuit identity. When a student is sure of who they are and their value system is intact and their languages are intact, you know, they can succeed in any setting, whether they're in Harvard, whether they're in Kotzebue or Barrow or Bethel or Akachuk or, you know, Yenoki. It doesn't matter which village, you know, that they're from. They're able to, because they have that strong sense of who they are, their identity is intact, then they're able to get, you know, use the tool of our Western educational system to promote their own values as well. And that's something that I've been able to do, you know, for the last 30 plus years.
Are there any schools that you think are already doing that really well?
I am very, very impressed with, you know, the school in Bethel. They have an immersion school there, and the name of the school escapes me for a minute here. Yeah, so we have one in Bethel that's an immersion school, and it's K, I believe it's K-3, and everything is taught in their Yupik languages. All the topics and subjects are taught in Yupik, and then once they hit third grade, I think it's when they start moving into learning English after they had their initial education taught in their own language. So that's...
And as you've tracked those kids as they've gone through 12th grade, those benefits have remained. They've been able to get enough of that throughout the rest of their schooling, even though they're not in an immersion school anymore?
I believe that the ones that have been involved in an immersion school system, and even the one in Kotzebue, you know, what I've heard is that they all do better than most students because they have had, you know, their initial formative years were taught in their own languages. And then also Northfield Borough School District with the Inuit Learning Framework, it's a continuous journey of learning about their own identity and their own language and their own value system. And then, you know, they're able to get out there and create success for themselves and for others around.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Other questions for Pauline?
Yeah. Hi, this is Tim Parker. I'm in Nakati today on Prince Wales Island, and Pauline and I have spent some time together talking about these frameworks, and I very much appreciate the presentation. Pauline, I was just in Kotzebue about 2 weeks ago, and I met one of the people on your that helped with the frameworks, Raymond Woods. He was there, along with Lance Kramer, who made a presentation to the district at their opening thing. And I was talking to them about the frameworks, and of course, Raymond was very familiar, and Lance was pretty familiar. But one of the things they brought up in our, when we were talking, we spent a couple hours together talking, we talked about barriers that people have run into, and they have very specific barriers to trying to get some of the frameworks into the schools themselves. Lance was telling a story about they had a walrus and they wanted to demonstrate how to make seal oil from the walrus, which I think fits in nicely into the frameworks and identity that you were talking about. But yet they ran into barriers on that. I wondered if you could talk about the types of barriers that you've seen and help us understand maybe ways we can get around those barriers so that these good ideas can come to schools in Alaska.
My thought is that, you know, we have, you know, we have current curriculum that the state mandates for the current school district systems to use, and then on top of that, you also have the testing system that occurs every spring based on that curriculum. I think that, of course, the curriculum itself is based on standards that are Western, you know, based on the Western knowledge system. And so to use what we have in our Alaskan Inuit Education Improvement Strategy, it means being very flexible and having a board, local boards and regional boards willing to take that risk and say, okay, we can use this framework in our school system, but we can tie that into the framework that the state of Alaska has, you know, with their system. But it entails people being willing to step out of the box and look at ways that you can use the resources at hand within each region. You know, each region has a particular season that they have, you know, for their subsistence activities. Of course, North Slope Rural Arctic School District has their whaling as the forefront of their subsistence activities, the whaling for the bowhead. And so that, you know, that can be an enormous resource of information and science and math and language that could be used, you know, to teach our students more about themselves, but also still give them the opportunity to, you know, to have assessed with the state standards, but I don't think that you have to separate the two. I think that you can create a system where you use both and the students are more apt to succeed because they see themselves in the curriculum, they see their own language. And again, the key, the crux is identity, is having our, and I'm in particular talking about our rural students that are living in Akitchik, that are living in, you know, in Norvik, or living in one of the smaller rural sites. I'm not in particular talking about Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau, which are the larger industries.
Well, Pauline, I can't thank you enough for all you've added to our conversation. I think that you've given a lot for our committee to consider. And I know we could probably spend all 3 hours with you, but because we have other speakers online, the First Alaskan folks and ASC folks, I just want to give you a big thank you and thank you for all the work you're doing. The work you're doing is really a good model of what we can consider and look at, and I hope that the committee has taken the opportunity to look through that. So thank you so much, Pauline. And I will be in touch with you again soon about potentially working with my folks. So thank you.
Well, absolutely. If you don't mind, I'm going to sit in and listen because I am very curious about the work that the Alaska Education Challenge is doing. So I will be sitting in and taking notes if you don't mind. Thank you.
I was just going to say we welcome you to stay on for the meeting. So thank you. So Lori and Andrea, are you both online now?
Hi, yes, this is Andrea. Good morning.
Perfect. Good morning, Andrea. Welcome, and I'm so glad you're calling in from your work in Bethel, and I'm going to turn it over to you ladies right now.
Yeah, thanks for having us. My name is Andrea Agashak-Sanders. I'm a tribal member of the Native Village of Quinnahawk on the Bering Sea coast, just south of Bethel. I grew up here in Montreal or Bethel, and I currently work as the director of the Alaska Native Policy Center, which is an initiative at First Alaskans Institute. I know Liz Medicine Crow, our president CEO, has been involved with this working group. So I just wanted to get things kicked off. I'll be presenting today with Lori Grass Green, my friend and colleague from AASB. So just to get things started, First Alaskans Institute, we've been involved in education policy advocacy for several years. Most recently, our work has kind of taken a social justice and racial equity lens. We got to know Timmy and some of the folks at AASB through our Andor project, which is Advancing Native Dialogues on Racial Equity. That work really sprung up around the time of statehood, when Alaska was celebrating 50 years of statehood. And some of our key leaders were interested in finding out what the Alaska Native experience was, and started hosting conversations around Alaska, asking community members, leaders, tribal leaders to weigh in on what their experience has been since 1959. And really the theme arose that racism, disenfranchisement, prejudice, systemic racism were still prevalent issues in Alaska today. And so that really spurred our leadership at the time to pursue funding to support work in this arena. So we've been hosting difficult dialogues across the state now with, tens of thousands of people, really challenging us to think about how we can learn from one another, share our experience and perspective, and grow understanding so we as individuals can kind of heal and repair relations and take that on within the systems and institutions in which, we work and serve and interact within. So that work has really taken off in the arena of our equity and education. We've done work in many school districts across Alaska, very small schools, as well as our most urban areas. And through Andor, we've really grown our partnership in working with AAS. The particular project we're talking about today is culturally responsive and embedded social and emotional learning. It's quite a mouthful, so we've been calling it CRESL. And this component of our work has really been grounded in coming out to communities, finding out what it is that the local community members, the elders, the culture bearers, what it is that they envision and want to see happen within the schools to kind of have more of a seamless transition from the home life, the learning that happens in our natural environments, on our land, as we're gathering our traditional foods and living our way of life. How can that better complement what's happening within the school district and within the formal school setting, so that our students are feeling a lot of the things I just heard Pauline talking about, strong in their identity, that they can walk in the door within their classroom feeling that they're being respected, that their way of life is respected, and that it's mirrored back to them and deemed important in the content and the curriculum and kind of the learning environment. And so we've been hosting conversations across Alaska. We've been generating a lot of ideas, and there are some key themes that are arising from across the different portions of our state. And I think folks across Alaska are feeling a really strong sense in wanting to see transformation happen within the area of how our education is being delivered. And I think Lori was going to chime in and share back some of those more tangible aspects of our work.
Sure. Thanks, Andrea. Good morning, everyone. So I'm just going to take one step back and then kind of join, pick up back at this place. But I wanted to say, you know, the Association of Alaska School Boards, we were a part of the ANDOR process, which was really great to be a part of those, the Visionary Council, and just be a part of those conversations, and to link that up with the goals that were outlined by our own board of directors. And ultimately, while ASB provides a variety of services, we're really advocates for youth, and our board of directors saw, you know, what was happening across the state and looked at the educational equity issues and established a goal around supporting and really boosting Alaska Native student success if the system wasn't serving those students as well. So timing-wise, a lot of things worked out, and a lot of the work that we're doing within this CRESL project, but also within a few other areas, is really working to support that work. And so it's been really exciting. Heather Coulihan and Conrad Frank from our office have been really involved with the CRESL project, and through the community conversations, which First Alaskans has a really, I'd like to say, beautiful process and agreements and tone that they set, safe tone that they set, and we work in partnership with First Alaskans and the school district and community partners that are interested to have those conversations. And really what's come out of those conversations have been a few things. I mean, one thing that's come out is just sometimes it's opened the door for immediate solutions. I can think of one community that Andrea and I were in where there was this belief that, you know, there wasn't a place to do some of the cultural activities, and this school was able to on the spot say, well, here, our door is open. And so there were sometimes immediate solutions like that. Sometimes it would be more about just developing an understanding between school staff and the community, or to create a space for healing around education and community experience. I think also, you know, an outcome of that is that through the questions that were designed specifically to look at the CRESL work, Timmy, I'm not sure if you were able to send that out this morning on our behalf.
Laurie, we'll put it on, after this meeting, we'll put it on the page, but we weren't able to get it out this morning.
Okay, no problem. So there'll be a document there, which is just a draft, but it's basically the harvests from conversations all around the state, and it's not identified by community. But there were a lot of themes that came out, and you know, some of those themes were around the environment and really incorporating values and really linking some of those values to maybe that academic thinking of social and emotional learning, but a lot of those things were the same thing. There was a lot of encouragement to really think about, sort of like Pauline was talking about, really how instruction was happening and what was being incorporated and how to use a sense of place and identity into building out the instructional practices. And there were you know, just a lot of themes that came out about ways of teaching, ways of learning, connecting with community, and so you all can take a look at that harvest. But what happened after the conversations, some community members would move forward next steps and things that really emerged from those conversations. And then the school staff also took that harvest and incorporated it into their school-based planning and said, well, what does this look like for our whole school climate or our environment? What does this look like about shifting our teaching practices? What does this look like for curriculum? What does this look like for how we model and what we do and what training school staff need to be able to do that and what systems and infrastructure needs to be changed as a result of it. So those are some of the pieces that were then incorporated into school-based plans, and those weren't one-time conversations, but they'll be repeated, so there's a feedback loop about what's happening, both independently by the school and in partnership with the community. So, Andrea, is there anything else you want to add around that piece?
No, I think that's a great summary, Lori.
And there's been a couple other, thanks Andrea, there's been a couple other pieces of work that we've been doing. And one, there's been a lot of talk lately around cultural integration and also around trauma-informed schools. And in a way, the CRESL project allowed us to bring some of those pieces together in a way that said, this is what it would look like in our community. This is what it looks like to have supportive schools in our community. About a year or two ago, working with First Alaskans Institute and some other stakeholders in the state, we worked on developing a survey scale to incorporate in the school climate and connectedness survey. And that link, I think, is also will be provided in the follow-up email. But it's a public link, and you can see the statewide data. And there's a cultural connectedness scale that's been added. And when you click on that, you can then really dig in to see what students said, what grades they were in, what was their cultural background, what are they absent in school, and looking at cultural connectedness compared to those pieces. And there's a variety of questions, and one is sort of general to how students feel, how connected they feel to their culture, and then there's questions about how culture is integrated into their schools and classrooms. And we can actually see that for districts that are participating district by district and school by school as well. So it's a neat new feature we have, and we're using that, as a part of this project too, to track, changes. And we also can see the comparison between students' responses and also staff responses. And we've noticed that generally, the staff were much more optimistic about the cultural integration than the students were at a certain level. So there's some, information that provides for us to think about how we move forward in thinking about our work. And then the last thing I was going to mention was another project that we are also partnering with First Alaskans Institute, and it's a project funded through Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and it's called Cultural Safety and Education. And we've really just started on it, but thankful that Liz Medicine Crow was able to join the two school boards that were talking about what does it look like to develop school board and school district policy that really creates the schools that we want to have. What are those transformative pieces that are needed around policy? And so there's a small group of folks that are sort of our think tank that have been going through school policies and really thinking about what changes need to happen. And I heard someone earlier ask about, I think Tim maybe, about the barriers to some of the implementation of frameworks. And, one of the policies that did come up was around food and how do we incorporate policies that are in compliance with the laws and still allow, subsistence in schools for schools know that there's less waste, students are happier with the food, it's more of a comfort level. So we're taking a look at some of these policies, and we're just at the beginning phase, but I wanted to mention that because I think it's also another unique aspect that we don't always, give thought to is what are the policies that are guiding what happens in the schools too. So those are the things that I was going to share out on. I'm sure Andrea would be happy too to answer any questions about the work that we're doing in partnership with seven districts and eventually 36 schools.
Well, thank you very much, Lori and Andrea. We really appreciate you reporting out to this group on that. Are there any specific questions or things that people want to ask either of these ladies?
This is Chuck. I really appreciate that presentation. Lori, I didn't quite get, I know you're working closely with ICC, but can you tell me again the organization or the group you're with?
Sure. I work with the Association of Alaska School Boards, and I personally am the director of the Initiative for Community Engagement, and our goal has really been about strengthening those relationships between school and community and providing supports for community engagement and student engagement and family engagement. So.
Okay. Would it be appropriate this time, I guess, question for the facilitators? I guess after listening to Pauline and Lori, I just have a couple kind of broad questions for comment. But maybe I should save that for the end.
Whatever works, Chuck.
Okay, I don't want to derail the agenda.
That's okay.
Okay, so, you know, we have this House Bill 102, which passed the House unanimously. It's now in the Senate. It's the one that makes it easier to get Indigenous language teachers and course content facilitators in classrooms without necessarily being a state-certified teacher. It allows that authority to be handled at the local district level. I'm hoping that this really helps facilitate the six strategies that Pauline identified with ICC, and additionally would help tailor the education to the unique and personal needs of families in all areas where the language content is so important. So we need a little help, I think, on the Senate side to get that through. But kind of a bigger thing that I just wanted to ask you folks is, when we talk about our education policies not reflecting Inuit worldview, resulting in current Inuits not living their traditional values. So they're Inuit, you know, in race, but they're not Inuit in value or culture. And then, you know, just reviewing the report, it makes a good case that if, you know, a strong probability for a solution to that is found in more self-governance. Is it possible under self-governance for us to provide the flexibility, the unique needs and choices that are needed to make that happen under our current model of funding education in Alaska? Or do we need a model that more directly gets money to entities that can more personalize the delivery of the education, and maybe a model that, you know, more limits regulations on the provider, so it's not as much regulation and more limits. I don't want to say the word avoid, but maybe more limits the state testing mandates that can sometimes drive the curriculum away from what is needed. So I know those are really big ones, but I really feel like with this group, it is something we need to talk about.
Well, I thank you, and I think that will be part of our discussion, absolutely, after the break, when we come back together, that those are some things to put on the table. So thank you very much.
Okay.
And thanks for giving it. It doesn't matter that it may not have been. I mean, I'm glad that it was just put on the table. So does anybody have any questions for Lori or Andrea before we do take a break? Well, thanks, ladies, for doing such a thorough job on that. It's great to hear so many positive things that are going on around our state. And between the work ICC is doing, First Alaskans, the Association of Alaska School Boards, it seems as though we have a lot of expertise that presented to us this morning, and we really appreciate that. According to my watch, it is 9:56. Why don't we plan to come back at 10:10? That gives everyone 14 minutes to go take care of your needs, and we will start back at 10:10. And I know some people have joined the call. We want to acknowledge that. But let's just go on break until 10:10, okay?
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Good care.
I think it's just...
And the
We're going to start back in 2 minutes just to bring everybody back, and we'll begin in just a few minutes.
Well, welcome back, folks. This is Norm. I'm, as you may remember, I'm co-facilitating with my colleague Timmy. Our next task in this process is to work out the final recommendations for our committee to put some closure around those and to come up with the rationale to support those recommendations. Now we've heard two presentations this morning that talk about a lot of the work that's relevant to the work of our committee and the charge that we have as a committee. We've looked at a number of readings and materials have been provided to you via Smartsheet, and we need to look at our three categories. And if you recall, those three categories were number one, tribal compacting; number two, values; and three, partnerships. And so keep those in your mind now. And we have one more presentation, and Commissioner Davidson is going to help us understand the first recommendation that we had spoken about, and that was tribal compacting. And I think there just needs to be a clarification of what tribal compacting could look like, what it would mean for our students, and so we want a clear understanding of that as we go forward. So, Commissioner Davidson, are you online?
That was going to be my next question, because we know she was landing on a plane. Are you on yet? Okay, maybe not. Can I ask who else has joined us since Aaron took attendance? We know that Tim Parker's on, Dina Mitchell. Has anyone else joined us that we are unaware of at this point?
Hey, this is Carolyn Kelly from Clinton.
Oh, hi, Carolyn. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you.
And Liz Mason-Crowe was not there for the original.
Carrie Boyd, are you on yet? Carrie was sending me notes.
Yes, I've been on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Liz Medicine Crow. I was on when the call started.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Anybody else join us then? All right, well, I think that as soon as we can get the commissioner on, we would like her to speak to us, but since she's not on yet, that's not possible. So, I think, Norm, I'll turn it back to you, and we can start talking maybe about the other two, and then once Commissioner Davidson gets on, we can talk a little bit about the compacting a little further.
Okay. The number two and the three recommendations we have were around values and around partnerships. And so I guess the thing to do would be to consider those one at a time. And so let's talk about values for a moment, and perhaps you can, I suppose we ought to just open this up and get your ideas on what values mean and exactly where we should go with this.
And what I really want to frame this in, everyone, is, for example, when Representative Kopp started talking about some of the things that he had on his mind, To me, those are the hows, how we can do it. And really, this committee, our work is the what. What do we want to see happen? Now, we will capture the hows and pass that on to the state board, but really our goal is to come up with the what. What is it that we want to see that will transform education as we move forward? And I know it's really hard because we all tend to go to problem solving and here this would help and this would help and this would help, but we need to focus on the what. And then we can, the group can put the hows in afterwards. But I'm just laying that framework out there. So, yeah, go ahead.
So we will open it up to a discussion of values. And we would like your thoughts, and we're going to be taking copious notes on this, around values. What do values mean to you?
What might a recommendation be
around
values?
And rationale to go with it, if you have that, please.
This is Chuck. You know, when I listen to Pauline, I don't know if Pauline is still online, but I was thinking of, you know, the of course Alaska Native cultural values, and so to me a starting point would be the Alaska Native Cultural Network, you know, where they, if you go to the ANKN website, they list the values for curriculum right there for us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, show respect to others. Each person has a special gift. Share what you have. Giving makes you richer. Know who you are. You're a reflection of your family. Accept what life brings. You cannot control many things. Have patience. Some things cannot be rushed. Live carefully. What you do will come back to you. Take care of others. You cannot live without them. Honor your elders. They show you the way in life. Pray for guidance. Many things are not known. See connections. All things are related. That's right off the ANKN website. And, you know, and this is, I think this is more of a compilation for many Indigenous groups, because this is under the Indigenous Knowledge System section, but so, you know, it may be slight variations between more specific groups, but at least here it says these are reflective of Aleutic, Athabascan, and Upiakupik, Tlingit, and the Nandan culture. So it gives us a starting point, the ANKN website.
Great, thank you.
Hello, this is Hattie.
Okay. Hi, Hattie.
Go ahead.
Hi. So I like how you're asking for values, but I think a big part of what we're missing is when we teach, you know, our culture and our language, for example, I think a big piece that might be missing a lot of times is reverting back to our values, like they were just stating. And I think a big thing is respect for elders, you know, sharing, honesty. So, you know, we have our list of values. But I think a lot of times what we see within, you know, our communities is, you know, we could teach someone to, you know, touch a seal and then, you know, turn that into seal skin and then, you know, make it an economic success. But there's parts of it, you know, so that their culture and our language could be looking at and learning the different parts of the seal, but remembering that we have to give back to our elders, you know, with our catch, and then remembering that we have to, you know, not keep one pattern that your grandma gave you and not let anyone else have it because you want to be the only mukluk. So, or no, we have to pass on these patterns and sharing our knowledge. So I think definitely values is a big core piece of, you know, learning our tradition and teaching our children. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you so much, Hattie. We really appreciate that input.
Good morning. This is Rachel in Sitka.
Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
Hi. So one of the things that that comes to mind is kind of practicing the values in, I guess it becomes part of the culture of the school. One of the So last fall or last spring when school was getting out, my daughter walked up to a teacher who was collecting all these books, and she was going to get rid of them. Like it was, you know, collecting books and they were getting thrown away. And the teacher shared with me how alarmed my daughter was because it was like, why are you getting rid of these books? They have value. There could be something, you know, they could be used. And she actually took a few of them and like even just to recycle them versus throwing them away. But that was, that kind of came out in how she was raised. And being that the school itself didn't have a process in place for setting that up so that there would be, you know, if there is something that could have another use, it, that's its process to, you know, you can't hold on to everything, of course, in the building, but when, you know, when it's time to let go of something, there needs to be a way to do that. And so kind of transferring a way of process for treating things, even. I don't know if that made any sense, but.
No, thank you, Rachel. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Other thoughts around this big bucket around values?
Hi, this is Zach.
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
Hi, I don't want to repeat everything that everybody else said, because I think that's great, but I really do think, you know, emphasizing the part about, you know, what our elders bring to the table for values is very important. And, you know, sometimes we're going to have a little bit of variation. You know, we're going to have our general overarching values, which I think Representative Kopp, you know, summed up very well from the website. But sometimes, you know, there might be in individual communities, even within school districts, you know, some values that might be slightly different. And I think it would be very good to incorporate our elders' input as to what those values would be in an individual community. For instance, you know, what might work, say, in the interior might be a little different than what might work on the coast or, you know, things like that. So I think generally they would be overarchingly the same, but maybe when it came to specifics, it would help to always have them kind of tailored to the communities.
Thank you so much for that input.
Yeah, I think that's valuable input there, that understanding that they have to be broad enough to cover all regions of our state. Anyone else?
This is Carrie.
Hi, Carrie.
When I think about that and listening to the speakers and reflecting upon it, you know, like when we talk about values, is, and I don't want to get stuck on the house, because it's so important that we do have those values in our schools, no matter where you come from. Everyone comes from all different walks of life and they have different life experiences, but there are some basic values that if we have them in our schools, it would help. It would help with the self-identity. And again, this can go to any area of the state. And, you know, we talk about different ways to promote cultural values and building upon the resiliency of our students. But getting at the core values could be a way to maybe explicitly help teach that. I think right now it's in the schools, but it's very loosely. It's not prescriptive. It's not, it's more accidental.
Thank you, Carrie.
Just from what I'm seeing.
And this is Patty again. I agree with Sherry. Finding a way that we connect these values
to, you know, our culture, our language, or, you know, the curriculum that they're teaching is just relating the values back to it. Teaching, so figuring out a way to teach the children it.
Yeah, I think this section, of course, is profoundly important. I think it directly ties into tribal and community ownership, which are focused on. And I think that one of the beautiful things that our indigenous culture does bring is literally an anchor to our whole society. You know, the values kind of really take hold on a very firm foundation that has withstood tens of thousands of years of human history to know what works and what doesn't. And I think that, you know, maybe kind of one of the things we're identifying is when we have an educational system that is maybe accidental rather and more haphazard in how values are encouraged or passed along in the education system, or maybe there's some fear or concern about the role of education in transmitting values, that's a hurdle we need to overcome and encourage our education system to, you know, get back to really emphasizing those in a powerful way, because they are such an anchor to our society and I think directly help go against the frame of our fabric of our society. So just underscoring, I think we're on the right track here.
Okay, thank you. And could I ask you to identify yourself? We didn't get a name there.
Sure, this is Chuck.
Thank you.
We think we knew all the voices, but we don't.
Yeah, you bet. Sorry about that.
No,
thank you.
Good morning, this is Val. I'm sorry I'm late.
Oh, we're so glad you're here, Val. We postponed talking about the first big bucket because we were waiting for you. So right now we're talking about the bucket around values, and we're just starting into, we've had a lot of good comments on that. And so you can catch your breath, and then we'll ask you to speak after we're done with this conversation.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you for letting us know you were here.
Hi, Deb. This is Dina. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Dina. Thank you.
I never know when this is on mute and when it's not. So, I love what was just read about the values on the Alaska Native, the ANKN website. And I think that community values and Native values are super important, but I think also we can't forget about the overriding issue of just really the value of education in and of itself, and having families, you know, support that with their children, and the importance of critical thinking and all of those things that we try to, the reasons that kids go to school. So, I'm sure we all feel like that's the foundation under all of this, hopefully.
Hi, this is Liz Medicine Pro. I think that just kind of thinking about what it was Chuck, and then I'm sorry I didn't catch the lady's name who just spoke, but I think those are kind of the bedrock and foundation for tribes and tribal communities and Native peoples here. So I think that there's a lot of synergy in that. I think that people, because they haven't had the ability to really be connected and really understand the value of Native peoples and the ways that we live, they don't see those connections, but really one isn't more important than the other. They're the same thing. We have the same values about educating our children, keeping them connected to who they are, building strong moral, ethical fabric into their lives. And that's what allowed us to actually be able to live and thrive on these lands for thousands of years. So there's not a hierarchy of knowledge. There's equivalencies, there's equity, and there's I think what I'm hearing in this committee, a recognition that that there's a way to synergize those things so that they actually, one, are recognized, because it's not that they don't exist, it's that they haven't been valued. And the other is that there's no more hierarchy in which way is better. It's an understanding that Alaska is a really unique place, and part of that uniqueness is that indigenous spirit and community that's really been connected here and that hasn't been valued in the process. So it's kind of like lifting away the veil that there's some sort of one system better than the other. And now that we have the ability to have two systems, two different worldviews, two different ways of thinking, we actually now have more knowledge content between both of us, you know, in this knowledge space. That's something that I really wanted to kind of riff off of the comments that started to mind, because I felt like there was that wonderful bridge that's happening, and that's exciting. So when we talk about values, I think that that's an incredibly important one.
Great, thanks, Liz, for that. So what we need to sort of to come to a consensus on or come to an agreement on is what recommendations are we going to provide to the State Board of Education? How do we articulate this to the State Board of Education? Does anyone have any ideas or thoughts on this? I think everyone agrees with the concept of values. That's what I'm hearing from folks. But we just want to kind of
how do we articulate it?
Put some sideboards around this so that we can articulate it in ways that we intend.
This is Dina again. I think the way Liz just articulated it was wonderful. That there need to be these equivalencies and recognizing the value of all of these different inputs and beliefs and systems, I guess.
Okay, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, I this is Chuck. Also, I would say that one of the things we could say is that there is no such thing as value-free education, and our committee recognizes that all education is built on a value system. And that we are just clearly articulating that, and that we recognize that it is the foundation upon which all knowledge is transmitted. It's based on an underlying value system, and that's why it's so important. It's like the bedrock.
And that's a really good Norma, the word I'm trying to come up with, rationale
yeah.
behind what it is that we want. So thank you, Chuck. I had too many R's in my vocabulary this morning.
Yeah. Great thoughts. Anybody else care to chime in at this point?
Hi, Norm. This is Liz Medicine Crow. I just wanted
yes.
to say that what I shared was meant to be an encapsulation of those things, and I appreciate that Dina. Dina also heard that, so I just wanted to recognize that. Finish Chief.
Thank you.
And I think with the Courtney probably hopefully was able to capture how Liz expressed it, and then how Dina was able to repeat that. Around the equivalencies between our beliefs and our systems and our values. Courtney, could I put you on the spot to read back what you have, maybe, and just to make sure we captured this correctly?
Sure. Liz, you can tell me if I missed some of your wording. So, educating our children's strong moral and ethical fabric into our lives, there's a recognition that there is a way to synergize. Alaska is a really unique place, and part of the uniqueness is the indigenous community. And I probably missed some of what you said, so I don't know if you would mind repeating that.
And do we have this recorded?
This is all recorded, so we can go back in there and capture that. So I don't think we need to put Liz on the spot for that, but we will try to encapsulate that. And I think then what Dina said basically was that there needs to be an equivalency between our cultures, our beliefs, and systems. And then Chuck, of course, gave some rationale because there's no such thing as value-free education,
and all education is built around some values and beliefs.
And these values are the bedrock.
They're the bedrock. Did we encompass all that correctly, speakers and the table?
I think so.
Yes, thank you. I think so.
It only took four of us to try and capture that, so good. we're all trying to take copious notes. So Matt, what is that we want to be, we want this equivalency around these values? And are there other rationale, thank you, Chuck, for speaking up, but are there some other rationale? And I think that what people said earlier, what Rachel said and what Carrie said and what Hattie said, I think could all be considered rationale, and we can dig those out of the minutes. But are there other things that haven't been laid on the table that we could see as rationale for why we want to move this forward?
You might want to think about the presentation by our three presenters and see if there's anything that resonated with you as they spoke that lends itself to some sort of a rationale about values and value systems in our education system.
This is Carrie. I don't know if this is what you're looking for, but what resonated with me is, and I forget the speaker's name, I apologize, was to promote the self-identity through culture and so that our children can succeed no matter where they are, whether they're in a small village, in the lower 48, a big city. And also, I really liked how she said that she used the tools through Western education to promote her cultural values. Sorry, I also can't speak today. That really resonated with me.
Okay, thank you, Carrie.
All right, any more thoughts or comments around, and I guess what we hadn't really confirmed, but I think our people, is there anyone, I guess this is the easiest way with this group, would there be anyone that would oppose this moving forward as one of our recommendations, one around the values? Is there anyone that has any concerns or some angst or worries about this one being one of our recommendations?
This is Dina. I guess my only concern about this is, I agree with Chuck, and I think that the goal of any education, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
The goal of any good education system is so that people really come out with a strong understanding of what their values are. I guess it potentially could open a can of worms. And there was something that somebody said earlier about each district kind of going their own direction, which I agree with to a certain extent. But, you know, obviously it could really, depending on who, I don't know what I'm trying to say exactly. There could be, let's say there were a group of, neo-Nazis, and they said, this is what we want to do in our community, and these are our values. I mean, I think there have to be limits on it somewhere to control that type of thing.
Thank you, Dina, for bringing that to the table.
Okay, caution noted.
Caution, yes.
This is Rachel. One thing that keeps coming into mind is around the rationale, and I definitely support having values as one of the items, is just that there are so many influences that come at our children from all different directions, and keeping a consistency throughout the education program that is aligned with our homes and our communities. And one of the challenges that we do face is that we have teachers coming from outside the state of Alaska that don't understand the way of being in our state because they haven't lived it. And so how do you translate, and maybe that's the how, but but looking at an education system that then supports our teachers, that allows them to understand all of this that we're trying to make happen, and to translate that into a way of being in the school.
Okay, we heard what you said, and we're definitely making a note of that. It probably does bleed over into the how, but we have it recorded, and we'll make a note of that. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Rachel. And I think the other important thing you said, Rachel, was the whole piece about consistency with home and community, because it isn't just the school's responsibility. There are a lot of other values that come from the home and come from within the community. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? We don't want to leave this with something unsaid that someone has, but in the interest of moving it along, we want to make sure you have time to talk, but to move it along appropriately.
This is Liz Medicine Crow. I feel like what we talked about sounds good. I know that you have a chance to go back through the recording, but we'll have a chance to actually read what's being written before,
yes,
kind of formally and finally saying, yes, this is it.
How I see this is that we'll put together a draft for the committee to consider, and then yes, it's your message, not ours, and you will have complete control of that. Rest assured of that. Thank you, Liz, for bringing that up.
All right. So as we move forward, I think we're going to back up to bucket number one, which is tribal compacting. And I know that Jerry had spoken with Commissioner Davidson recently and thought that she would bring some good voice to our table. So, Commissioner, could I turn it over to you to share some of your thoughts and vision around this bucket?
Sure. Thank you. So maybe before we talk about education for a minute, I want to sort of set the stage for why tribes are so interested in doing work. One of the things that I learned in my 15 years of working in tribal health was that the closer to home that you can provide care, if you can provide it in a culturally appropriate manner, in the language that people understand, and you meet people truly where they are, we have much better health outcomes. And so we have certainly seen that play out. So in, for example, in tribal health, statewide, here's just an indication of the impact. The Department of Health and Social Services has about 3,500 employees. The entire tribal health system collectively has 7,000 employees. Their economic impact in Alaska is about $2 billion a year. Collectively, they bring about $2 billion into the Alaska economy. Many of those resources they would not have been able to bring because as they can now, because they are tribes and tribal organizations, they are eligible for grants that state and federal agencies are not eligible for. And they are also eligible for additional, so those can be private foundation grants and other kinds of opportunities. There are also a number of federal grants that are available to tribes and tribal organizations that are not available to states. And so that has made a difference. And it was, you know, it has basically been a 40-year journey. And in the beginning, what folks heard was, well, you know, are tribes really going to be able to pull this off? This is really complicated health policy. And the response back was, well, providing that level of care from no matter how well you do it, it is based out of Juneau or based out of Anchorage or based out of Washington, D.C., is not going to yield the same results as being able to be on the ground in the home community. And so as we have moved forward, we have seen incredible advances in healthcare delivery. And from the Department of Health and Social Services perspective, quite frankly, the tribal health system is effectively the public health system in our state because there is a clinic in every community in our state, and the state does not have that opportunity. We have some public health clinics, and we are incredibly grateful for those, and they provide a valuable service. And I'm not going to downplay their impact because it's significant, but we don't have the resources to be in every community. And so the tribal health system does that for the state of Alaska, for everybody. And every tribal health organization in the state has a what's called a non-beneficiary resolution, which is a non-IHS beneficiary resolution that allows them to be able to provide care to non-IHS beneficiaries. They have to charge for those services, but they're available. And so, for example, in rural communities, veterans care is now provided in rural communities through the tribal health system, whereas before a patient would have to first fly from, let's say, Imaluk to Anchorage, be seen to determine if they needed care, go back while the determination was made, determine that if, yes, they did need care, and then be flown back to Anchorage for that service when the service was available right in their home community of Imaluk at the tribal health clinic. So it has led to greater collaboration and less duplication of services and services being provided in small communities that quite frankly wouldn't exist without the tribal health system. And in other states have county health systems. Alaska doesn't. We don't have counties. And so the tribal health system has really developed and built that infrastructure that the state has not had to build. But we still benefit. So there are other folks who, you know, worked for many, many years who were federal employees in the federal Indian health system, and it was really, really hard for them to let go. And it was kind of like, this is not the best analogy, but it's kind of the best one I can come up with. It's kind of like, you know, when you're a parent and you raise a child and you're ready to send that kid off to college, it is heartbreaking. You know that's what's needed. It's hard to let go, but you have to in order for that person to develop into the person that they ultimately are going to be. And it's hard to make that analogy to this situation because I don't want to sound, you know, that we're being paternalistic or maternalistic to tribes and tribal organizations. That's not my intent. But it's the same kind of emotional connection that long-term state employees feel about the education system. But if you take a step back and you think about what's best for communities and what's best for children and what's best for families, then it's pretty easy to see that, okay, maybe it isn't so important who signs my paycheck, as long as the work is truly reflective of the communities that we serve. And so to that end, we've heard things as we, so as we have done that, we've had, the state of Alaska has had, the Department of Health and Social Services has had longstanding partnerships with tribal health organizations. And last year, we negotiated agreements, care coordination agreements, brokered agreements between tribal organizations and non-tribal organizations that allowed them to be able to extend their level of care by providing services and memorializing referrals that were already happening naturally, that allowed the Department of Health and Social Services, We were looking to save $32 million in FY17, and we ended up saving $39.9 million in general fund, simply because we are allowed to have a greater federal match, a federal match enhancement, because of those care coordination agreements with tribes and tribal organizations. And it's what they wanted to do anyway. And so it was a win-win for everybody. So the other thing that we looked at is we are now in the process of compacting child welfare services in Alaska. And here's why. We have a significant disproportionality problem in our state. About 22% of the kids in Alaska are Alaska Native or American Indian. But when this administration came in, 62% of the children in out-of-home placements were Alaska Native or American Indian, 62%. And we have done some work. We were able to bring that number down. I think the last number I saw was about 58%. So from 62% down to 55%. 55% is still not acceptable. And so we knew we had to do things differently. And so as that applies to the education system, what are the percentages of, we know that Alaska Native children make up 22% of the population of children in our state. So are 22% of the kids that are graduating from our education system also Alaska Native? Are folks who don't make it through the system, who are leaving the education system because they are dropping out, are those numbers of kids, are 22% of those kids Alaska Native, or is that number higher? If it is, we have a disproportionality problem. So something is happening there. And so what we are doing right now in child welfare is we have asked the hard question of, we have communities where it is really hard to recruit positions. I'll use the region that I'm from, Bethel, and we just had a cabinet meeting in Bethel yesterday, which was incredible. It's the first time we've had, I think ever, a cabinet meeting, a governor's cabinet meeting in a rural community. And in Bethel, I know that in the Bethel region that we've had a really hard time filling social worker positions at the Office of Children's Services. And so we challenged ourselves at the department to think about, because I have friends who went to college and finished with social work degrees, and they're interested in doing this work. And so I asked the question, we're not filling these positions, but I know people who live in the region who could do this work. So is the issue that they don't want to do this work, or is the issue they don't want to do this work for us? And I know a number of people who wouldn't necessarily be interested in working for the state, but are interested in working for their tribe and tribal organization, and they take great pride in being able to give back to their tribe and their tribal organization and their region. And so as we're thinking about recruiting for positions, we need to think about all of the incentives to make sure that we do whatever we can to be able to entice local people to take those positions, even if it means maybe we're not the ones that they would work for. So as we are having those conversations with tribes and tribal organizations, and I should tell you that it is very, very intensive work. Some tribes are interested in licensing foster homes. And that makes sense. They're the ones who live in the community. They know who the families are. They know their family's history, et cetera, and they're in a much better position to be able to recruit homes and to be able to do the licensing, because sometimes, unfortunately, sometimes I think the standards that we have as a state may be totally different than the cultural norms in that community. Here's an example. Today, if I wanted to be a foster home, a foster parent, I'm not sure that I would pass. We are messy, but we assure our fun. I travel a lot for work, but my mother lives with us. Stable home environment. We've taken kids in before. Any kid who needs a safe place is welcome here, but we aren't a foster family. And it's a cultural placement, which is something that we have done for many, many years. And I know of all of my friends, almost all of them have taken in nieces, nephews.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's for a short amount of time, and sometimes it's longer. My niece and nephew came to stay with me for a weekend and left. One of them left a couple of years later, and one of them left about 6.5 years later when she went off to college, and then came back, because that's how these things work sometimes with kids who are going to college. And so really, when we are looking at how do we improve our services to tribal members who are disproportionately represented in our system, we have to really ask the hard question, are we the appropriate person that or party or agency that child and that family should be dealing with? And we struggled with all of the same questions that I saw happen on the tribal health side when tribal organizations began to take over health services. Everything from, well, are they sophisticated enough? Do they know enough? Are they prepared enough? Are they et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And all of those reasons we've heard before, and, you know, what if something happens? Well, those things also happen when we provide that care, when the state provides that care. And so we know that tribes and tribal organizations have incredible records of delivering healthcare services, and we know that they have capacity and the experience to be able to do that in another area. Now, as we're working with tribes and tribal organizations, you know, some are ready to do smaller things, like, you know, maybe it's helping us with home visits and taking over home visits, because that's all that they feel that they have the capacity for. Other tribes or tribal organizations, like Kuwerok, is interested in assuming all child welfare services and assuming control for all of those services, because they've been providing those services in communities for many years. But what has been so impressive in this entire process is that even among sort of the naysayers on the state side, they have commented repeatedly how incredibly impressed they are with the tribes and the tribal organizations' ability to be able to assess what they are ready for, to be able to assess what they think they can start off with and what they need our help with. And really asking those questions about, and us having conversations about, well, this is what we're interested in doing. A tribe has said, this is what we're interested in doing. We have experience here. We would like to be able to provide this additional service, but we're going to need your help to get there. And okay, well, let's talk about how do you do that? What kind of support can we provide you to make sure that at the end of this whatever time period they determine that they need to be able to take on that will be able to work on a plan that will help to get there. Because there is, I guarantee you, there is nobody more incentivized and more inspired to ensure that good quality services are than tribes and tribal organizations who live in those communities, because they always want the very best for their children, and they will move mountains to make that happen. And many times, tribes and tribal organizations have more flexibility. They're able to bring other resources to the table that, quite frankly, the state does not have in this economic environment. And likewise, on the state side, we need to make sure that as we compact, we're having those negotiations and compacting services, that we don't, you know, saddle them with the responsibility to provide a service without the resources to be successful. That also means, though, that we don't hold them to a standard of perfection as an excuse for why we can't move forward when we ourselves are not meeting that standard of perfection. So, yes, we want to make sure that home visits happen within a certain time frame. That is our standard, and we will move mountains to get there. But if we're not meeting that standard, it sure seems unfair to require that of them and use it as an excuse for why we can't allow them to try to do better. I would describe it as an incredibly intense but very deliberate process. And there is no question that is asked that is ever unanswered. I mean, we still are struggling with some things that we call sticky issues, whether it's waivers of sovereign immunity, whether it's, some tribes may be interested in having state employees still be state employees, but have them be detailed to a tribal organization where they're still a state employee, but they are co-located at the tribal organization that is in a better position to provide wraparound services for those children and those families. So we're still working through those, and one of our philosophies has been from the very beginning is we have several ground rules. One is from the state's perspective, we are on a path to yes. And our response isn't, no, we can't do that because fill in the blanks about all of the reasons why it's too hard. Our path to yes requires us to be able to say, yes, we can do that if these requirements are met. If there are challenges meeting those requirements, we figure out ways to be able to meet them. Does that mean we provide some of those services for a short amount of time or a longer amount of time until they can get up to speed? A whole host of things that are really very different than it's a very different thing to ask somebody, well, is this something we can do versus this is something I'm going to do. Is there anything that precludes me from doing so? And if there are barriers, how do we remove them or how do we address them so that we can provide this care as close to home as possible? The other thing is one of the ground rules is transparency. We share information freely. We do have separate state caucuses and tribal caucuses because there are some things we just need to be able to work out among ourselves. For example, a larger tribal organization like AVCP provides care under the authority of 56 federally recognized tribes, whereas another tribe may be representing one tribe and their own. And so there are issues that may need to be worked out between larger tribal organizations versus individual tribes and making sure that everybody has the infrastructure necessary to make sure that they are all successful. The same applies to us at the state, where the tribes have said repeatedly throughout this process, we have to make sure that there are sufficient resources at the state to make sure that the state can continue to support us as we move forward. The other ground rule is
people have to, at all times, understand the implications of the decisions that we are asking people to make. And if they don't understand the implications, then we need to have to spend more time talking about that decision. Because if it's a negotiation, and if I pull a fast one on someone, I may have a good deal for that short amount of time, but it sure has compromised our partnership, and it sure has compromised that relationship, and that person is probably never going to trust me again, and rightfully so. And so we want to make sure, and we are very deliberate about making sure that we talk about what's happening. Okay, here's what's going to happen. Here's a proposal to do this. Let's talk about what that means. What does it mean for the state? What does it mean for tribes? Is there a difference between large tribes and small tribes and how this impacts them? But we don't use those conversations as a reason to not move forward. We are always moving forward. Let's see. What else? And, you know, if I look at the sort of the comparisons between health versus education, you're sort of, it's the same journey all over again. And, you know, years ago when the federal government was providing this care, there were local advisory boards, but it wasn't enough. It didn't accomplish what we really needed it to accomplish. And with that, I didn't know if that's sort of what you had in mind, or I didn't know if, I know Liz is on the phone, if she wanted to provide more comment or more context.
Hi, Val. That was really fantastic. I don't really have anything else to add at this time. I think we really covered a lot of really important elements of why contacting is so transformational. And also kind of starting to build that bridge on how it may look at connect this thread to education. So I think that was really great. Finish two showers.
Brianna, Liz.
Okay, folks, you've heard Commissioner Davidson talk about how compacting has worked with healthcare and now moving forward on children's services. So do you have any questions for the commissioner that you would like to have answered?
Hey, this is Tiffany.
Okay, go ahead, Tiffany.
I don't know that it's necessarily a question for the commissioner. Maybe it is. One of the last comments was about how advisory boards weren't enough. And when I look at education, like I look at my board in particular, and the school board's not an advisory board. I mean, we're the ones making the judgment calls for the district, what our graduation requirements are, what our curriculum is and everything. And for like just my specific board, 6 out of 7 of us are local native, and the one that's not is Native Hawaiian. So like I feel like for my board, we cover, I want to say, 4 tribes in our region. So I feel like our local tribes are relatively involved, like, as at the highest level in our school district. So how would compacting change the way we operate? I mean, my concern is that especially in our rural regions where they're so small, that it could have a detrimental impact to the public schools. I mean, is your vision that education be compacted? I'm having a hard time speaking. Compacted, and then similar to the health clinics, they're the only provider of education? Or I'm looking for a little bit more clarity, I guess.
No, I'm not. Just as in the healthcare system, there are other health organizations that provide healthcare.
And the key to compacting is that tribes and tribal organizations determine for themselves what it is that they would like to do. So nobody forces a tribe or a tribal organization to do compacting in-house. That's a tribal decision. They make that decision on their own.
Okay, other questions?
But that was a great question. Thank you, Tiffany.
This is Dina again. Val, thank you so much. That was just such a passionate and wonderful explanation of how this all works. And I had some pretty long discussions with Doug Eby about how things work with our federal foundation. And I feel like there are so many parallels between healthcare delivery and education delivery. You know, I mean, all across the board, you have to have everybody. You take them the way they are. Everybody has a different, you know, everybody is a unique individual, and we need to understand where they come from and what their needs are. So I feel like if we could somehow do a similar process to what has been done in healthcare, it could really revolutionize education. I don't know what it would look like, but I guess my question, too, is it sounds like you've been focusing more on the rural areas, but with 20% of our students, our children in Alaska being Native, I'm wondering what percentage of them actually go to school in Anchorage and the Valley, because it seems like a lot of them do come into the more major metro areas for school. So how would it look for those communities? And obviously it works for healthcare, so there's a way to do it. And maybe we don't even know what it looks like yet, but it's starting that conversation and starting the process. And
that's a great question. So the answer is every community is different and every tribe is different. So same thing happened in tribal health. What about Anchorage? And because we were able to work through those issues, we have South Central Foundation who's providing those services on behalf of tribes in the Anchorage Student Service Unit, and we have the Alaska Native Medical Center, which for many years was the only level 2 trauma center in our entire state of Alaska. Providence got level 2 trauma status, I think last year or maybe a year and a half ago. And so it adds another element, but it's still very much possible. And with regard to for child welfare compacting, we're not just talking to tribes and tribal organizations and rural communities. TCC is at the table in the interior. They also work with families in Fairbanks. Clinton and Hyde is at the table. They work with families in Southeast, as well as in Juneau. And Cook Inlet Tribal Council is also at the table, and they serve tribes in the Anchorage Service Unit. And so it's really, in terms of education, it's really starting the conversation and getting a sense of what is it that families want, what is it that tribes want, and what is it that they want for their tribal members. What's their capacity? What are they interested in having you provide, et cetera?
Well, I would love, love, love to get that conversation going, because to me that is radical transformation right there.
Yeah, and it really has been. And sometimes it's a matter of, like on the health side, there are still services that are purchased and referred services. But when you are in the position, when a tribe is in a position of being the customer and being the dollar holder of those services, it is a whole level, different level of engagement, and you get a whole different level of customer service than happened before. It's no longer a given. It's no longer guaranteed. There are performance standards that have to be met just like anybody else. And it really, if we are looking for transformational change, this is it. But I don't want to underscore the amount of effort that it will take, but where it will get you in terms of a long-term partnership moving forward, it is incredible. And I know in the child welfare compacting, one of the other things that we have said in our meetings, in our negotiations, is that, we said at our first meeting, and we repeat it at every meeting,
And here's what I, one of the things that I say, because it's important to repeat it. Because we are doing this for the first time in our state, we're going to make the very best decisions based upon the information we have and the information we don't have. And no matter how well we plan to do this, we're going to miss something. We're going to make a mistake. And that's okay. That happens with innovation. And when we make those mistakes, we are going to honor our relationship with each other and our newfound partnership or our strengthened partnership and make sure that the other party knows. And we will have the opportunity to be able to make corrections as we go along so that when mistakes are made or things are caught that we didn't anticipate, we come back together and we talk about how we're going to address them. But one of the things that I certainly saw in tribal health, and it's already started happening here in child welfare compacting, is when we catch those things, the difference because we have solidified those relationships or established relationships that didn't exist before, when we catch those things, we don't make harsh assumptions about each other and sort of build our own story in our own heads about how the other party was out to get us or they were doing us wrong, et cetera. In the same way that if your best friend, when your best friend says something to you and it's sort of a little bit jarring, how you react to that is very different if that person is your best friend versus a person who might be your arch enemy. I'm not sure those exist anymore, but and it's what makes it the same message delivered, but what makes the difference is the partnership. And this is an incredible way to be able to build true partnership with tribes and tribal organizations.
Okay, folks, this is Norm again. You've heard a lot of information, and we're trying to narrow the focus down and move forward. So I guess the question would be, is there consensus, is there agreement from the committee to move tribal compacting forward as one of our three recommendations?
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is Chuck. Absolutely. 100% behind that, and I absolutely love Valerie's analogy of letting go of your children. I think it just was a beautiful word picture of this whole process. We have to let go of things at the right time to ensure a good harvest in the life of our children, and we have got to go from dependence to independence, and I'm 100% behind it.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Anyone else who wants to chime in on this, please?
Yeah, this is Zach. I too, 100% behind this. I think our tribes know our communities best, and it just makes sense, especially all the more sense after hearing Commissioner Davidson's excellent discussion about how it's working with the healthcare system. So I think it's absolutely should be one of our recommendations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is also a time if people have some concerns or angst, it's also a time for those people to speak up. We want to hear from both sides of this discussion as we do with all of them.
Jimmy, this is Geraldine Kelly from Quinhawk.
Hi, Geraldine.
I am in support of the tribal compacting, but the one thing that concerns me regarding if our schools were under the tribal compacting, would we still qualify to get state funding for our schools?
Well, I'll tell you, Jerry Lynn, we don't know what it would look like. And I think Commissioner Davidson was very clear on that. that it's the beginning of a process. We move forward, and who knows what it's going to look like. I doubt that folks, when they started healthcare, knew what it was going to look like. So there's no answer to that. Yeah, Jerilyn, thanks for that question.
Can I answer how we're doing that on the child welfare side?
Certainly.
On the child welfare side, the answer to that question is yes, because we can't ask a tribe or tribal organization to assume services that we have provided without resources. And so the question is, what does that allocation of resources look like?
Thank you for the clarification, Commissioner.
Yeah, this is Chuck. Just to follow up on that, the question that I asked early on is, can we get a true self-determination? Can it occur in our current model of funding education? And I think, we all recognize that regardless, we have state dollars set aside and dedicated to the public funding of education. But I think how that looks like could be transformative in the way we address that. And that we may have to look at models of education delivery that right now, under our current way that formula works, statutory, there may be things that need to change. But to get at true self-determination, we have to be willing to look at that.
Thank you, Representative Cox. That is that's an important message from a policymaker.
This is Liz Medicine Crow, and I also wanted to touch base on Gerilyn's question, because I think it's also really important to reiterate that the state will still continue to have its constitutional and legal obligations to provide education to its citizens across the state. And so those things will continue to be present, and that's part of, I think that's one of the exciting parts about the conversation is, you're spending the money already. If it's a money question, you're spending the money already. Will you get a better result if you actually work with the tribes in those communities and allow them to make the decisions about how best to provide that? And that's really, I think, kind of a quick summary of what's happened with our healthcare services, and also what's moving forward under DHSS is that it's about how do you actually get the bigger return on your investment. And that's the transformation, the financial transformation that will also help advance more of this work and as we move deeper into the conversation about compact.
Well, thank you, Liz. Is there any objection? I guess I would ask the question this way. Is there any objection to moving forward as one of the three major recommendations being a tribal compact?
Norm, this is Tiffany.
Yes.
I'm not objecting, but I just want to put out a couple of thoughts. And I know it might, one, a concern just being for how it might affect school districts if part of their tribes decide to compact and some tribes don't. I mean, just I wanted to make sure that we're taking all those things into consideration. And then I know we don't know how it's going to look, but there are different models throughout the country. WASDA with Washington is looking at how they're interacting with their tribally compacted schools and just how they, whether it's funding or if they're, are there public school, I just lost my train of thought, I'm so sorry. But I'm not objecting, but I just want to make sure that we are aware of some of the concerns that people may have. And I'll end my comment there.
Okay, thank you. Tiffany, we'll try to encapsulate those into what we put forward to the committee.
This is Chuck. I think an important thing that I think our whole committee recognizes that's driving for this is that we really do believe that our accountability for academic outcomes and for taxpayer dollars will actually improve under this model. That's one of the reasons we're doing this.
Thank you.
We don't yet know exactly, as the previous speaker said, how it will shape up in every area. But we recognize there has to be flexibility built into this so that voluntarily these contacts can occur at the right time when people are ready.
And Representative Kopp, that sounds like a rationalization that we can put in there. Thank you for that.
Yes. Any other comments or thoughts? And again, everyone will have input to the written document when we finally put something together. This hasn't gone forward to the board yet. We're just starting to put things in writing. So, all right, hearing none more, nothing more. I know that we haven't taken a break, so I hope people have just taken care of their own personal selves and done what they needed to do. But I would like us to just stay online and try to make it through the next 30 minutes so we can at least have the conversation around the last bucket that we had and see if it becomes a what we would like to see. Again, not the how, but the what we'd like to see. And that topic is around partnerships, and it's a very broad title right now, but I think that if we open the gate waters on this topic, and remember, we don't have to make, if we only had one recommendation for the state board, that would be fine. We don't have to use all of these, so it could possibly be that partnerships falls into two of the other categories we have, or it could be a standalone. But it's just the topic to open the door. So would anyone like to begin the conversation around our bucket of partnerships?
Well, we've certainly talked about this is Chuck Cobb. We've certainly talked about how critical it is to partner with tribes. And and also with organizations like ICC, who have already done significant education improvement work.
I'm going to ask Aaron to read the comments from the last meeting just to maybe get our brains going a little bit. And again, I think this might be a challenging one of what does this look like. So Aaron, could you just highlight from the last meeting those for us?
Sure. So on page 5 of the meeting notes from the committee's last meeting, the third bucket was entitled Explore a Process of Creating Transformational Partnerships. And some of the sub-bullets described partnering with all sorts of entities, partnering at all levels, strengthening relationships, input is invaluable, anyone that shows an interest or a passion, defining and building partnerships to link schools with community. So those are some of the highlights from last meeting, a quote from folks to help maybe prompt some thinking.
This is Hattie.
I'm ready.
Hi, I went to the ICLDC 5 Language Revitalization Conference in Hawaii this year, and how they had their partnerships, which was amazing, is everywhere from zero to college, all of their schools work together. So their child, well, not all of them, but certain programs like Punana Leo, they had their daycare, preschool, Head Start, elementary school, and their college working together. So I think that would be a great partnership to start working with their colleges. But also our Native corporations, and I believe our different corporations in our region, for example, as I mentioned before, NSCDC held an education summit in our region to see what we can do to better education, working with partners who are interested, like, for example, in our region, NSCDC, and our Native corporations, too, that are involved, but also our cities, too, as well, because our cities do provide a financial budget and provide, well, like for Nome, provides a budget for our school year.
Hi, this is Erin with the department. Is there a report or any kind of summary from the conference you mentioned from Hawaii that you could send to us?
Yes, I can send that. Do you have a good email address if you were down with us?
Sure. Erin.Hardin, H-A-R-D-I-N, at alaska.gov. Thank you. That might just help prompt some of our wordsmithing and to see an example.
Sounds good.
This is Liz Medicine Crow, and I also wanted to bring up some work that we've been doing at First Alaskans Institute with Alaska Pacific University. We hosted a dialogue, a community dialogue, and then a think tank at the end of July, where we invited some guests from New Zealand who had been in leadership roles in developing tribal universities. A tribal university system in New Zealand, and the notes are being compiled, a video is being made of their presentation, and if the timing will allow, I'm hoping we'll be able to share that out with the group as well, because while they were talking about a university, the dialogue that the community had and in the think tank space, there was lots of other connections all the way through all levels of education, and that might be helpful as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Are there other comments?
And again, I know we're in the home stretch of today's meeting.
This is Duna again, and I think partnerships are really critical to improving our educational outcomes. And I guess I just feel so strongly that the whole contacting process could really there's so many partnerships that have been attempted, and there's so many partnerships that work effectively but could work better. Here in Anchorage, we have the School Business Partnerships. United Way has tried to provide wraparound services as part of their 90 by 2020 and build more partnerships. But I think if we really could take that contacting process and get that going in a significant way, that the partnerships would be we wouldn't be able to avoid them.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, do you see that this then becomes,
it's a rationale for why contacting could be so effective. And other people can chime in if they don't agree.
That's what I was trying to spit out of my mouth, Tina. Do we see partnership as part of why compacting or rationale around compacting, or does it need to be a standalone?
This is Tiffany.
Go ahead, Tiffany.
I see where you're coming at, but where Regina is coming from with that. But I also think that it's important for us to keep it in the forefront as well, because there may be tribes that choose not to compact, but we still want to, we still value their input and want to work with, and not just tribes, but even if compacting isn't pursued, partnering would still be critical to education.
So maybe, I hear what you're saying, and I completely agree, maybe it could be partnering could be one area that we think is very important, and we could also put that as a rationale for compacting, that if we were pursuing that, that natural partnerships would evolve probably in a very, very comprehensive and strong way.
I agree.
This is Carrie, and I would just have to agree with the partnership. I think that's essential. The days of us working in our silos really need to end, and we have to have that. And I think it will work, would be compacting, but I also think it should be a standalone.
This is Rose Medicine Crow, and I'm thinking about partnerships. I want to apologize if what I say right now is going to offend anyone, because it's not meant to. I'm just trying to think about what we're asked to do. And I'm feeling challenged myself
in the context of thinking about, so we're talking about compacting as a recommendation, and I think we all see and understand the transformative power of what could come out of that. We may not know all the details or have the quote unquote how, which I think is not really part of our charge anyway, but in thinking about partnerships outside the context of the compacting, if we say, okay, that's one recommendation that's going forward, partnership is also gonna go forward. So there's obviously some connection to compacting, but on its own, what is the transformative movement under partnership that we're going to put forward? Because I feel like what I'm hearing and what I've heard others say and what we've shared is a frustration with the lack of partnership when there's so much richness and opportunity around the space to do a better job doing that. But I'm not feeling particularly convinced yet that those statements are transformative in terms of the recommendations. I don't know if I'm saying that well, but I guess what I'm saying is, what is it about partnerships that's going to be transformative? What's our recommendation in that area?
Very good point, Liz. Thank you for bringing that up.
And I'm not saying it to be problematic. I'm actually, this is the challenge that I'm having thinking about it. So I'm not trying to diminish or anybody else's previous comments, because I think partnership and all of the richness of opportunity that we have out there, those things are super important. But in terms of a transformational recommendation around it, what would that look like? Am I forgetting something? And again, you know, I apologize if the way I'm saying that is rubbing people wrong. I'm not trying to say that at all. I'm trying to think, like, how could I formulate a recommendation on partnership in a way that's transformational?
This is Rachel, and I agree with you, Liz, with kind of the thoughts that you're having and the struggle right there. When I've been looking at partnerships, I look at how I do that in my work with the Chamber of Commerce and how we partner with the business community. And one thing that comes up over and over and over again is economic development, workforce development. What are we doing right now with our students so that they're ready to come out into the workforce and be part of this community and be able to live here and stay here? What are we doing to develop our business community so that there are jobs when they are done with school, so that their parents can live here, so that we can have, like, it's all interconnected. And so when I'm going, yes, I support partnerships, that's kind of where my mind goes, is into how can we bring in people so that there is that ownership in that we're serving their need being, you know, employees and being, you know, that you are, and then they're going to be invested in making sure that the schools are successful because they're getting what they need, and it also serves the community, and it also serves the students because it's this interconnected web. And so I don't know if we've identified that, you know, this tribal ownership and that we can get that by having the compacting, but do we want to maybe isolate into a category or two into what types of partnerships we should encourage to make that transformational change?
Thank you, Rachel.
Kimmy, this is Jerry.
Please, Jerry.
Thinking of Liz's comment, I really appreciate her thought and her context. And as I was listening to her, I was thinking of information that we have from what's happened in Ontario, Canada, in terms of how they have progressed. And obviously they engage in compacting and they engage in different types of partnerships with Indigenous and not Indigenous organizations. What struck me about Ontario, however, is that they kind of use a somewhat different term, and they call it deep collaboration, working together, in a very significant way. and maybe it's just a different terminology of partnerships, but it strikes me that perhaps what we're talking about here and what would be transformative versus a traditional partnership would be some level of deeper collaboration that would occur between the education system and organizations that are not directly responsible for education. Thank you.
Any other comments on partnerships? We've got two trains of thought here. One is making partnership a rationale for a tribal compact, and the other one is having it a standalone one of the big goals or the recommendations out of the committee.
Well, this is Chuck. I think that it is because the partnerships will look different in every community based on resources available and businesses, groups, entities, nonprofits, you know, wanting and willing to work with the education system, it will look a little bit different. So I think it works either way as a standalone or not, you know. I was thinking about this huge partnership that the Northwest Arctic Borough has with several large trade associations in Alaska, welding, carpentry, and they have a whole trade high school there in Northwest Arctic Borough. I forgot the acronym for the name of that school, but they're, all of the kids when they graduate are immediately employable, and it's all done in partnership with the business community who is training them to do the jobs available in their villages. So to me, that's just one idea of a partnership. Obviously, that's not available everywhere, but.
I certainly appreciate all the dialogue around this, and I think that in the next step process, as we look at this, what I'm wondering is one of two things. One, is there someone who feels strongly that this be a standalone that might give the team here at the department some words to begin wordsmithing around how that might look like so that the rest of the group can get feedback to it. And the reason I'm trying to push this along is we really only have one more phone meeting. And that phone meeting is, Aaron, what date are we? I'm sorry. I think it's the 19th, if I'm not mistaken. She's checking on that. But we only have one more meeting, and at that meeting, we really need to fine-tune all of our recommendations. And so is there anyone out there right now that currently has some verbiage they'd like to share with how we might consider this or at least take a look at it? And I know at this point, at 2 hours and 45 minutes in, people are starting to lose focus, including myself. And so I just want to make sure that those of you that know me know that, but that we have some verbiage that we can work with as we move forward. Anyone? Is there anyone willing to?
This is Liz. I'm not willing to give you verbiage now because I'm still not there in terms of framing something that's transformational or in partnership that is valuable. Not that I don't see it as a value or as a component, but I'm just trying to think about what would we change in the area of partnership that once changed would never be able to go back to what it was before. What would be that transforming factor? I'm still not there yet. I would like a chance to think about it some more. Besides the fact that everybody else is silent when you ask, I think people are also kind of thinking about it as well.
I would agree, Liz. And I guess what I'd leave it at then, unless someone else was trying to chime in maybe?
I agree with this is Chuck. I agree with what Liz said. I almost felt like I needed to kind of come up with a checklist to assess the development of what we're looking at for clear vision and goal of these partnerships. And then I could give a better answer.
Okay, and then as you look at and remind that on today's agenda, it talks about that, you know, as we're kicking off this meeting, the system changes are transformable changes, which include practices, processes, and products that anticipate, reflect, and refine the need of significantly different systems or environments. So, you know, what I'd like to do is give this group, you know, we have a long weekend coming up. People could think about this, but if anyone on the phone right now has some words that they'd like to put down on paper and get to Aaron by Tuesday, then on Wednesday or later in that week when things get mailed out, we could include that. If we don't hear anything from Aaron, from anyone by Tuesday, then Aaron, Norm, and I will assume that maybe this it's a little mushy to call it a transformable change. Can we agree to that?
That sounds good to me, Timmy.
Yeah.
This is Dina.
And I'm not going to pinpoint anyone, but if anyone has words that they want to send to Aaron, feel free to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
So you have Thursday, Friday, long weekend. Get it to her on Tuesday if you have some thoughts.
And we're certainly not trying to control this discussion or to manipulate it in any way. We're just trying to move it along. That's it.
That's our role. All right, so the next meeting, please, please, please pull out your planners. It's September 19th, 1 o'clock, correct, Aaron?
Mm-hmm.
We're the 1 to 4 on that September afternoon, which means it'll be a beautiful September day in Juneau, no doubt. but we look forward to that. We will get an agenda out for that meeting. But that's the one. We're going to have to really work hard at that one. So we need everyone to come with lots of brain power and energy because we're really going to need to solidify the recommendations and the rationale as we want to make the presentation to the State Board of Ed.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for calling in. We really do appreciate it. Any other thoughts for the good of the group?
Have a great long weekend.
Be safe, everyone. Thank you if our presenters are still on. Thank you, Pauline and Lori and Andrea, for your helping set the stage. I think it was great. And Commissioner Davidson, thank you for your eloquent talk to us as well. We appreciate everyone's input. So thank you.
Brianna.
Thank you. Hi, this is Heidi. Are you still on the line? I just had a quick question.
Sure.
Okay, so I was wondering maybe if you could email, I don't know, if you, maybe not to the whole group, but maybe just to Melanie or myself, just the exact wording of what maybe that me and Melanie could work on together for sending in some words if she wants to. So I just wanted to kind of
get that. I would hope that maybe Courtney can jot off some of, she can pull from the minutes and send that to you, Hattie, you and Melanie. Do we have your email, Hattie? Hattie, we need to get your email, though, because we only have Melanie, so just a sec.
Okay.
Okay, Erin's going to write it down.
So my email is hkeller, K-E-L-L-E-R, at coric.org. K-A-W-E-R-A-K.org.
Thank you so much, Hattie.
All right, thank you. Have a great day.
All right, anyone else? Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.